Good evening, welcome. Zen is amongst various things, a practice of inquiry, a practice of questioning everything. I think if we have no more questions, Zen dies. Or at least goes to sleep in a stagnant swamp. I find for myself, the more I practice, the more questions I have. Some of them we investigate from all different angles, and we actually find answers. And some, maybe the best kind of questions, we don't find any answers. The deepest questions are ones that don't have any clear answer in the way that answers usually come. And we do this inquiry internally and externally. I think that this is the spirit of Dokusan, where we meet, teacher and student meet, and explore a question together. Sometimes it doesn't necessarily have to be a particular question, or we might not know what the question is, and as we start talking, we realize what it is. Or we go with one question, but as we start talking, we realize actually we have a more important question. And it's not so much that somebody is asking a question and someone's giving an answer, but more exploring together. Because we get input from more different minds, we get a more rounded picture of reality. Still a picture, but a more well-rounded one. So, with this in mind, do you have anything to bring up this evening? Particularly, like, what's on your mind, like, about practice, what's most vital for you, which might be totally different than yesterday and totally different from tomorrow. But this evening, we've just gone through a day together. All kinds of stuff has happened in our day, and maybe it's been a long day, or too tired to have a question at the end of a long day, but what's, you know, particularly in terms of we're all been practicing for a while, what's your most vital practice issue? Yes, Stan?
Dealing mindfully with aging.
And is it, what's the question?
That is the question. How does one deal mindfully with all the infirmities and challenges that come, and lack of memory and all the other things that come when you're like Joyce and I in our 70s and beyond?
Yeah, it's a good question. And
I thought our minds for a while too.
I still think of myself as a young person. You know, as I'm almost 50, I have to stop saying that after a while, I think. Maybe it's already too late.
Yeah.
Well, like you say, it's all relative, right?
How old are you, Kokyo?
About 48. What do you think that's young? Do you call that young?
I call that young, yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anybody younger than 48? Ah, yes, two. Ah. Well, I'm an old guy. That's another interesting fact to note, that a room full of almost maybe 20 people, there's only three of us under 50. What's going on with Zen practice? Is it not it's not hip anymore or something? Anyway, I might not be able to say so much. Maybe other people have more to say because I'm not 70 yet. But and in fact, my physical and mental faculties, I haven't noticed that much change. A little bit of change since in the last decade or so. Yeah, sometimes kind of like memory stuff a little bit. And I've heard that it gets more that way. Yeah, well, you'd have to ask him. But I think that our, you know, practices that we apply to everything apply to that. Especially deep acceptance of that it's a completely natural. Joyce is shaking her head. Because it's what's happening for all of us, right? So I think actually contemplating, in other words, remembering old age, sickness, and death, is good before it hits, you know, and while it's hitting. And then it's maybe not as big a surprise, or, you know, especially death, you know, the Buddha talked about a lot, really, like, and we might think that's a strange thing to do in our culture, is like, well, for alive, especially like all healthy and going strong, isn't that kind of a downer to think about our own death? But in fact, I think it widens the picture. It puts things in perspective.
It helps us appreciate what we have.
Yeah, it helps us appreciate what we have in the moment. And it becomes a very natural thing then to be getting old and losing faculties. And I think there is a kind of like, I think this thing of acceptance, you know, it's easy to say, but of course hard to practice. And but the more we really are at ease with the most fundamental source of who we are, like our true nature that doesn't age, actually, right? There's some quality of who we truly are that isn't born, doesn't age, doesn't get sick, and doesn't die. And it's like the mirror that never changes as old age is reflected in it. And the more we appreciate that too, I think the more we can watch the reflections come and go with more acceptance. And I think physical, I mean, maybe for some people who are really physically active, that's the hardest part. I mean, people have told me about this. They're like, my mind is fine, but my whole life has been about sports or exercise, and when I can't do that, I feel like I've lost my identity. Some people feel that way, and others feel maybe like, that's okay. I wasn't so physically active anyway, but my mental faculties, that's really hard. I mean, our senses is hard, but I think maybe the most hard, I imagine the most hard, is our actual mental faculty, which includes memory, but like, you know, as we get really older and older, we have like confusion, you know, with like Alzheimer's, things like this. But I do remember a person who I consider a teacher of mine, even though I don't know his name and only met him once, you know, over the course of a few days at Tassajara. He was a guest one summer, and I think I was the pool cleaner, something like that, and he was swimming in the pool, and so he kind of called out to me like, oh, "Hey, Frank, come here a minute." I'm like, "No," I look around. "No, yeah, you, Frank." I go up to him like, "No, you must have the wrong person. I'm not Frank." He's like, "No, Frank." he was going to tell me that's who I was, and he proceeded to just start talking the way some people whose mental faculties are waning sometimes talk. Like, it didn't make any sense, really. Although, it, you know, it made sense grammatically. But it was stories that didn't hold together and didn't really have to do with me, and it was a whole story woven together. And part of it was him telling his life of many, many, many years of Zen practice. I think at Rochester Zen Center, somewhere other than Tassajara. And so he had all these stories about his Zen experiences and practice with great joy. And he was quite confused. And I think at some point, you know, when I would try to correct him or tell him who I was, and like, I think he kind of had a sense that he was kind of out there. But like, what impressed me the most, and why I still remember this, is it seemed to not bother him at all. He was having fun, just delighted to be swimming around and talking nonsense. And I mean, it was nice that he had an ear to listen to him, his stories. And but I think he had others too, other ears, because he was such a kind of good-natured guy. He was a very pleasant, good storyteller, even though it made no sense. And I came away feeling like, well, if I have Alzheimer's or lose my mental faculties, I vow to be like this fellow. And I felt that it was his practice, his years of practice, that was like, again, I would say it is trusting something that doesn't come and go. Even like, I'm totally confused. I probably couldn't even like get through the day or feed myself without help from others, which he was getting. Some people don't. That's harder, I think, right? But since he was getting that help, it's kind of like okay to just let it all go. And I think that's rare. I think we resist. I am my mental faculties. That's who I really am. I am my sharp, clear mind. And if I lose that, I have nothing. And I felt like he had lost that, but he didn't have nothing. So.
There's a regular who comes down to the Royal Kitchens or the Carnation Garden at the Nelson Senior Center for lunch. Her name is Anita. She's in a wheelchair. She's partially blind and can't move. But she is right on in terms of being able to communicate and really care and communicate that caring. Even though she can't see and can't walk, but she can feed herself. But I mean, she's a kind of an inspiration.
Yeah.
Down there like that. Really communicate and are really as much as they can be warm, loving human beings and expressing that.
I think that caring quality too, which probably comes again from a lifetime of being that way. I also think of I imagine in our old age when we start to lose everything, and even in the dying process when we're really losing everything, all in a way, all we have to rely on is cause and effect, as Neti spoke about last week, deep faith in cause and effect, like. The conditions that have led up to that moment are going to keep playing out, and as we have less and less control. I mean, we never have control, really, from the beginning, but it seems like we do, but when it becomes clear that we really don't anymore, then what's going to happen? What is our way of relating and so on? It's going to be based just on the conditions of our life up to that moment. So we could say, some people do say, all of our practice is just preparing for, like, the moment of death, or when we start to lose it. Yes?
Did Frank give this practitioner the listening ear that you abide with him and listen to him? And
yeah. At least for that time I was there, partly because I enjoyed it too. It was so unusual for me. After that first turn of like, a kind of feeling uncomfortable, like, I should get out of here, he's got the wrong person, he's crazy. I think once I started warming up to his, the way he was, actually it was quite enjoyable to hear the stories that were like, even like little, you know, Zen pointers, because he really was steeped in practice. But it was only a couple of days that he was there. So if I had to listen to them, those stories, all day, every day, for years and years, it might have been harder. It might have been harder, yeah. But that's you know, in a way, another question is, how do we practice with those who are close to us, who are losing their faculties of body and mind? And in a way, you could say same thing is like remembering their true nature that's not that stuff that they're saying, and remembering our true nature that's not hindered by the annoyance on the surface. Like there's always one who's not annoyed, even when I'm annoyed, and that's really hard to remember when I'm annoyed. But I think it's a practice. Yeah. Yes.
So I think it's a great example of how important Sangha is, because you know a question that. The real serious question is how our culture views aging and death versus other cultures where there's extended family and people don't worry so much about getting old because they'll be cared. They know they'll be cared for. They know they'll be respected. You know, their wisdom counts for something. And so the question then course becomes, well then, what are your support networks? And here, for me, in my life, this is certainly one of them. You know, it matters in terms of where I feel supported and can come. And one question is, well, given that we live in a culture that one, isn't comfortable with death, in my opinion, and two, has lost the sense of, or lost the connection of extended family. You know, where people leave and they leave home and they go away and instead of family, it becomes a challenge of how do we on our own decide how we're going to move through this. A lot of times, in a fairly isolated way.
Yeah, we do have an interesting phenomenon in our modern American culture, which we maybe take as the norm, but I think it's quite unusual in the world. Yeah. Yeah. So like you say, Sangha is a community of care, and we have, you know, besides it's the natural formation of Sangha just by showing up and being here, we're connected with others, and then we have the specific things like the Sangha support net that's like designed to be like mobilize around someone in need. And even the Buddha, when we I think of the Buddha's monastic sangha, and that was a little different because people like would leave their families and join the homeless sangha. But in that case, the Buddha did say, when you're in that sangha, that's your family now. In a way, like your true family. We even say that in our, I think in our Jukai ceremony. We say, this is your true family, your true name, your true family, and your true dress when you get a rakusu. And,
it's worth it right there.
Not to discount another family we might have too, but, hopefully all spiritual communities will take care of each other in one way or another. Is somebody else decide? Gene. Please, yeah, please.
One of the things on my mind lately is the inquiring into the value of form in our practice and how rigidly or not rigidly to hold it, to assert it, to model it. And of course, under that question is inquiring into if there are no forms or minimal forms, when does Zen stop being Zen?
Yes, great question. Yeah, I have that question myself ongoingly. And I think this is the question of Zen in America and Buddhism. Maybe other traditions too, but just to speak within this tradition of Buddhism, particularly in America, because I think in the Asian countries of origin, people don't experiment too much with the forms, just go on and on for century after century. Of course, they do change, like the Japanese forms are very different than the Indian forms of the time of Buddha, and some are and some aren't. So it does evolve, but there's always that form and structure. And I think it's a great question for all of us to keep exploring. What is the function of it? You know, there are people in America experimenting with totally minimizing the form. I think in a way we can't eliminate it. The latest issue of Buddha Dharma magazine is all about form and this actual inquiry in all different Buddhist traditions. Quite interesting discussion. And one article brought up the fact that like we can't really avoid it because if you just say, I'm just going to do the essence practice of just sitting, nothing, and they won't even have any technique and no particular ritual around it, just sit. But then already we have to decide what posture we're going to sit in. So already we're in a form. You could say, well, just like a lean against this tree or something. Even that's a decision, right? Well, I'll close my eyes and see where I fall. I mean, no one goes that far anyway, right? We're choosing, if we're sitting upright, that's a form and a tradition that's been handed down. If we're sitting inside, we have to decide whether we're going to face the wall or away from the wall. Like we can't avoid it unless we're outside. So is it totally random? I mean, I sit in my room sometimes and I have that question. Do I face the wall or not the wall? It's a form question. And if you do one or the other, they have slightly different effects. So, I think if there's no form at all, then yeah, it might not be Buddha Dharma anymore. Might be related and inspired by. And then on the other side, do we have to do it exactly like Japan? I mean, it's already too late because we're not. How much do we keep and how much do we adapt and how quickly do we change? In a way, it's a kind of conservative versus innovative element. And or we all fall somewhere into that spectrum depending on causes and conditions of our own lives, basically. So I don't know what the causes and conditions of my life. It's a little bit surprising because I feel like I fall more into the conservative side of the spectrum of let's really honor this form that's been passed to us, even though it's different than the Buddha's form. Like, you know, why choose the Japanese one instead of the Chinese? Well, it's the kind of closest thing that's been passed to us. But it's surprising because, to me, it's in a way surprising because before Zen, I was really into the hippie mode of, it's kind of like, it has its own form, but it's also kind of like, it's kind of questioning forms and going outside the form, the traditional forms, right, of society. I'm not sure. I think, there's a long conversation that we could have and will continue to have, I'm sure, about like what is the function and value of form in Zen, form and ritual and ceremony and ways of doing tradition and lineage. All these things are hooked together. And I think, you know, offhand for me, what comes to mind, one is just, it's not really a practical thing, but it's just more an aesthetic thing, is to me it's like very beautiful. Not necessarily like that the Japanese aesthetic is beautiful, although I think it is, but I think it's very beautiful to like maintain some a certain way for a long time, and even through different cultures. There's something like that's just naturally beautiful about that. And why is that beautiful? Maybe partly because our culture doesn't have so much of that, right? Where America, maybe more than any culture in the world, we're the melting pot, right, of all these cultures. So even like, you know, maybe Europe is the closest to us, but Europe has much more deep-rooted traditional cultures. And, you know, the size of, we would go from like state to state in Europe, it's like country to country, that same size, with a completely different culture and language and customs that go way, way back. And because we don't have that so much here, I think it's refreshing to offer some of it. And also, it comes to mind something like the almost like that the form could be seen as like a kind of a matrix that almost like secretly holds the ineffable, you know, unnameable, formless source. And if you just say, let's just have the ineffable, formless source, well, what is it? you can't say, well, here it is, we have that without the form. It's only what's held in this kind of container or matrix that kind of, it's woven into the fabric of the form in a way, and we can't exactly find it that's woven in, but it's expressed through the form. So that would be another reason why if we lose the form, then we actually do lose it. And some people might say, well, Buddhism's been going in this country for, you know, at least 50 or 60 years. That's a long time, so we should start like totally changing it around. But in fact, in the history of Buddha Dharma, you know, that's just like a drop of time. I find it interesting to study Buddhist history and see how the tradition did evolve in these different countries and how long it took, like centuries, you know, before Indian Buddhism became Chinese in China. and so on. So if we change it too fast, we start changing around the matrix that holds the source, and then we might lose part of the source without realizing it. Well, this is an antiquated form. It doesn't serve us anymore. We throw it out, but we don't realize actually it had this function, but it's so subtle. I think many of our forms are like this. Some are quite obvious, some are quite subtle. You know, the structure of how a spiritual community is set up, roles and functions, and ordinations. What's that all about? let's study the history, what this was about. If we just make it up completely anew, I don't know what it is anymore. So in a way we have this relationship of the form and the source, we might say, the formless source. And you can't have you can't really find the source maybe without the form. But also, if you have just the form but without the source, that's another problem, we might say. That's maybe a harder one. That's trickier, because what is the source? It's unnameable, ineffable. We have some sense of it maybe through the form. But I think it's possible to have the whole structure of form set up and in place, but the formless source is kind of like dried up and withered. It's possible, and maybe not so uncommon actually. We're doing the form perfectly, but like the heart of it is not alive. And then some might say, well, if we're doing the form, perfectly is not the right word, but if we're doing the form wholeheartedly, then the heart of it is revealed. So, great questions, yeah.
Many years ago, I spent time at the San Francisco Zen Center, and I lost interest in many years past. When I came back, recently I got interested. And here I am. And I was wondering what would be different. I think that was like almost 35. It was 1979. By the way, in those days, if you were 48, you were really an old person. I think Greg Anderson was 35, and Richard Baker, I don't know if he was 40, maybe 39 or 40. So the average age was probably 25, 30, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
31, I think, and
I was
a little older.
Anyway. And now it's the same people still there.
Then I came back and I was wondering what's going to be different. And I was pleased to see that most everything seemed the same. But one thing that did strike me was the Dharma talks. They've become more personal, and more about the human relationships, and less formal. So I like that change. It seemed like it adapted to the American mentality a little more. The other thing I haven't noticed, I haven't been to the station, but I haven't seen, what's that stick you have?
Oh, yeah, the Kyosaku.
Where's that?
Yeah, it's gone. It's no more, yeah.
Oh, I like that.
Bring it back.
It used to really wake you up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it has a function, so.
Mm-hmm. That's gone, but everything else seems to be the same. And
similar, yeah.
The Dharma talks are a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Like it.
Mm-hmm. And maybe Tassajara practice period occasionally. That's an interesting one, you know. And I think as I understand it, there was a lot of discussion about that. And is this part of the Zen tradition that's like almost like a central part? And I think probably some Japanese people would say, yeah, without that stick, it's not really Zazen. Some might say that. I mean, it's so universal in Japan. And I think less and less common in America. In fact, I don't know of anywhere except maybe Berkeley and Tassajara that maybe use it sometimes.
You could get it when you got Yes, you'd also get it if you were nodding out.
Yeah. So I think that was one transition. Is first it was not by request. That's the Japanese tradition. Almost nobody would request it in Japan, but you get hit a lot anyway. And then maybe the transition in America is like, let's not hit anybody unless they want to be hit. And then, like, even if you want to be hit, we're not going to let you. Because what I heard is there, it was around issues of past abuse. So people who, you know, even though you didn't have to request it, just to be in a room where lots of people are getting hit and it's loud, right? It's obvious to everybody it's happening, was like really disturbing to enough people that they're like, this part of our culture. I think there is, you know, that kind of physical abuse in Asia, but it's seen differently maybe. It's more like that's just part of like child raising or something. I don't know. It's just, it's culturally it's different.
Mm-hmm. But I don't care. It's just the
only
thing, one of the things I noticed.
Yeah. Well, welcome back. Yes.
I don't have any opinion about the evolution of forms, but I have long felt that the forms carry us. It literally picks me up and carries me, regardless of what my field may be. It's only in a community, of course, not at home. But when it's time to sit, you sit, and you come in the door a certain way so that you're aware of the awesomeness of the chance to enter the venue. And the forms just carry me along, regardless of what my mind may be doing or my emotions.
Yeah.
Which is a blessing.
Yeah, and that might be one side of things, like it doesn't matter necessarily so much what it is, as long as there is like a way to do something, mm-hmm. for example. And sometimes, even within Soto Zen, things are pretty specific, but there is variation amongst different temples in Japan. So sometimes we like, well, it's a little bit arbitrary, but let's do it this way just so we have a way. I think it's, you know, I know we can get too overly strict with that too, but they hold us, and I think that's part of the function. I think one function of how they hold us is relational. Like it's a way. I mean, Zen is somewhat unusual tradition in that it's a very group oriented practice, like sitting, and a lot of all Buddhist traditions maybe would do chanting together, but like, not necessarily like eating side by side together and sitting meditation together. It's maybe a little bit unusual. So if you're going to do that, then you almost, to have that go smoothly and like support a kind of like deep presence and settling, then it's really nice to have a way that you can silently negotiate the room and not bump into people or say like, are you going to sit there? No, I'm going to sit there, you know. Like just people getting up at random times and coming and going and stuff. We do it kind of together, and it supports everybody's settling. So it's relational with each other, and it's also relational with Buddha, we could say, as represented by the altar in the center of the room. Is like, it's like, is a form to represent the formless source in the center. And so we create things to relate. All the forms are kind of relating to each other or to the practice itself. I think they do hold us. Yes.
Some of your thinking about this, I have a friend who leads a center on the East Coast, and the two women who lead the center have given up all the forms of dress and so on and cut it to something very simple. And the idea is that to practice the essence of the practice without being distracted by any of these distinctions among people based on things like garb, you know. And so, in a way, it's a sense of moving to a deeper practice, more essential practice, by removing the forms. And like Charlotte Jokel Beck removed the Buddha and all that from the altar and had a rock on the altar. You know, a sense of the essential nature of reality, rather than a picture of a form of a person of a particular ethnic group, usually that's not even the one the Buddha was. So that's, you know, what a lot of people are working with, I think, in a very respectful, very devoted to practice kind of way. They're reducing all this stuff.
And formality also is intimidating to some people and can separate people. I know, like, Tony Packer is another one who did very traditional Zen training, but then she also grew up in Nazi Germany as a Jew, I think. You know Tony Packer? And a wonderful teacher, I think, and was... Kaplo Roshi, you know, passed on the Rochester Zen Center to her, and she said, I'll only take this on if I can completely, like, you know, drop all the form and tradition. And I think she maybe tried going that way and people didn't like it, so she had to leave and start her own place with no form, and the Zen Center continues in the traditional way. And her thing from this German background was, as soon as you have any, like, ideology or, like, you know, religion, even anything that is some thing that you believe in that's different from others, that's like the seeds of, like, disaster. So, and she felt so strongly, like, we can't even have... She did come up with her own forms in some ways, but very few of them. So watching how it separates. And I think also, it's part of... Because our culture is so a non-traditional culture, I think people are more drawn to the formless styles, like the Vipassana Center down the road, where they have forms, but a lot less. They don't do, like, chanting, and it's kind of ritual. And it's much more popular than traditional Zen. And I think that's just something about our culture. I think if you offered that in Asia, I think it would be not very popular, actually. Like, some people are trying, and there are little movements, but the traditional way is people like that. It connects them to something larger and more ancient. Did Jean have a response? Did you want to ask?
I'm just Jean? Curious, when you think about relinquishing some form, what do you think?
In a nutshell, because I think we're getting close to time. I think they're not necessary and very useful.
Yeah.
Well, there's a whole thing to be said about that, which you will talk to us about sometime.
Maybe another talk at another time.
Just because what Jean says has to do with how we embrace the attitude of the form, not the form so much itself. But what I hear is that it isn't so much a question of the form, but how we embrace it, you said, with sincerity or with, you know, with heart and whatever. That's enough.
And also, when I say, and it's relational, and it's also, it's this way that we relate to each other to keep things harmoniously, to harmoniously support our kind of settling into stillness. They're kind of designed that way. But also, it's a nice way to kind of work our attachments and aversions, right? And it's nice, that's a really nice thing too about tradition, because as soon as you start inventing something new, then it's somebody's opinion. I mean, the tradition was originally someone's opinion, they had to deal with that. But if we just take it on in the way that's been given to us, it's nice because it's not personal, mm-hmm. right? It's like been given to us, and we just, like, the form that we do here, probably all of us, there's some pieces we really like and some we don't like. There's pieces I like and don't like. but then it's a package, right? And if we got into let's vote on every little thing that we do and which form to change according to our preferences, and then people are like, well, they won because they had the majority. Like, I don't like that form. We don't have to get into that. We're just like, here's the tradition. And, you know, it's possible to get stuck in that side too, I think, but maybe less sticky. And then our attachments around, here's a certain way to do it, and then it's not like it's right or better, but then if you have a way, then we can say, oh, actually, could you do it a little more this way to make it like that way that we do it? And then we're like, no, but I want to like personalize it a little bit. And like, well, we our forms have room for like a little bit of personalizing, a little bit of creativity, which is nice, but just the right amount, maybe. And we get to see our attachments and aversions. You just set up a somewhat arbitrary form, and that is just, we don't even know why sometimes. It's maybe even nice if we don't know why, and then just like, oh, can we do it more like this? And then some people are like, no, let's do it more like that. And then we're just, then the practice is, can we just surrender to that form? It's quite hard sometimes. So we have a form of ending Dharma talks before it gets like really dark. So I don't like it that much because I'd rather just keep going. But Joyce has a question, but you're willing to give it up. Okay. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are